Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment. You may be seated.
Good morning. Before we begin with our first case, I just want to announce that Justice O'Donnell will not be here today, but he will be participating in all of the cases today, and he'll be doing that by reviewing the video of the oral arguments. Our first case is entitled State of Ohio versus Megan Goff. Ms. Brown.
I'm Paula Brown, and along with William Bluth and Richard Parsons, I represent Megan Goff. Megan Goff was convicted. Oh, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. Megan Goff was convicted of aggravated murder with a firearm specification for the killing of her clearly abusive husband on March 18, 2006. That evening, Megan desperately tried to convince her husband not to kill her and the children. When he continued to threaten her, and when he told her he knew where she had hidden the children away, acting in self-defense as a battered woman, she shot and killed William Goff.
That was the defense theory of the case. I understand the state's theory is a little different, and would you say that the jury agreed with the defense theory or agreed with the state's theory?
Your Honor, it was a bench trial.
Oh, the judge then.
And the judge did find Megan guilty. Megan immediately called 911 in what can only be described as a truly haunting tape. Megan pleaded with the dispatcher to protect her from her husband, whom she believed was going to get up off the floor and kill her. This was after she had repeatedly shot him. If there's ever a tape that reflects the voice of a truly traumatized person, this is the tape. And we ask that the court listen to Trial Exhibit 63. At the scene, Megan spoke freely with the officers, and she gave two statements that night to Detective Bollinger. In her first statement, she still believes that William Goff can harm her and the children. As she states, "I just don't want him to hurt the kids." It was clear from the relationship that Megan was a battered woman, and it was clear that she had the right to present expert testimony. This court and the legislature have recognized that there are a group of women in our society, and that because of their abusive partners and because of the battering that they go through, that they can be described as battered women. Battered women syndrome enables this court to judge Megan's claim of self-defense as to other women similarly abused. In making that comparison, Megan should have been found not guilty.
Ms. Brown, I know that the defense theory of battered women's syndrome has become better established in the law than once upon a time. In fact, it's now specifically identified in 2945.371F. How does that statute that references the battered women's syndrome defense not support the state's argument that the legislature intended for the state to be able to compel the psychological exam?
Your Honor, we believe that they're the only things that can be compelled, the only examinations that can be compelled are when a defendant raises the issue of insanity or competency to stand trial. And 2945.371 deals with insanity and competency. And Section F, it's our opinion that Section F deals with a battered woman who's claiming insanity. Completely different than this situation where Megan was battered woman self-defense.
Is the statute then unconstitutional on its face or unconstitutional as applied?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is the statute either unconstitutional on its face or unconstitutional as it was applied in this case?
Are you speaking as to 2945?
Yeah.
I don't believe that that statute is unconstitutional. I believe that Section F doesn't apply to our situation.
But your argument is she cannot be compelled to submit, right?
Our argument is that in Megan's situation, where she raised the defense of battered woman syndrome self-defense, that there is not a statute that provided for the trial court to put her in the impermissible position of either undergoing a psychiatric examination or foregoing her battered woman defense. And the judge who ruled on her pretrial motions was not the same judge who presided over the trial. And although we contend that that judge who did the pretrial motions erred when he ordered the compelled examination of Megan, he did recognize that expert testimony needed to be in line with 2945.371J when he held the following in the pretrial May 17, 2006. He said, if you have an expert and want to bring that expert in, if you don't want to, that's fine. Then I would not order the examination on behalf of the state. It has been stated by counsel for the defendant that they're going to bring that in, and the state would have a chance to go ahead and conduct their own with the defendant, which would come in for that purpose and that purpose only. It seems that what he was doing is what other cases have done when they have allowed compelled examinations for insanity and competency. They have severely limited that expert testimony so as not to allow any statements as to guilt.
So, counsel, basically you've got two arguments here. One, that there should not have been an expert, an independent or a state expert allowed to do so, and if so, Dr. Resnick should not have testified to any of the statements made that would go to the actual facts or could be utilized in determination of guilt or innocence based on a factual testimony. In other words, his testimony went farther than what it should have, and it encompassed areas that were questions of fact and were used to impeach rather than just a strict medical observation or diagnosis.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe there are two issues here. One, she should never have been compelled to have an examination, that there's no statute and there's no Ohio law that provides for that. And two, that Dr. Resnick should not have been permitted to testify at all. Dr. Resnick was a expert without an opinion. He got on the stand and he testified to what he considered to be inconsistencies between the state's evidence and what Ms. Goff had told him.
All right, counsel, setting aside whether or not there should have been an independent evaluation, but it's a state-ordered or state-requested, the fact that he could not conclusively say one way or another, you're saying that that alone should have precluded him from being able to testify because he was unable to offer an opinion?
Yes, Your Honor, that's our position, that he should have been able to get on the stand and say, I don't have an opinion. What he should not have been able to...
Why would he even... What use would he have been on the stand if he was only going to render, I have no opinion, on the central issue, which was the validity of the battered wife syndrome defense? You had that report prior to his testimony, did you not?
I was not trial counsel, oh. Yes.
But
yes.
there was a report stating that I can't make up my mind, I have no opinion, I cannot, as a medical expert, cannot render an opinion on this case, right?
Exactly, Your Honor. And prior...
Why was he even on the stand?
Prior to trial, or prior to the time that he testified, trial counsel did vigorously object to him testifying. And he said to the trial court, he should not be able to testify, he doesn't have an opinion, and it's a violation of Megan's Fifth Amendment rights. And trial counsel said, or trial court said this, not fully being fully advised as what the law is, the court is going to rely on, I'm going to sustain the ruling of the prior court and proceed with the testimony. Since we haven't fully argued the law in this case, and neither counsel nor the court is fully apprised of what the law would be in this particular instance. And Dr. Resnick was permitted to testify. And as the state has said in their brief...
Well, what did the judge mean by the judge was not fully apprised and the lawyers weren't? Is there an ineffective... assistance of counsel here, or was he only referring to the prosecutor?
I'm not sure who the trial judge was referring to. That certainly issue, the ineffective counsel certainly have been issues that we have raised.
Yeah.
But the state in their brief has also conceded that Dr. Resnick didn't have an opinion, that he was called to testify as to inconsistencies, and he was called to give other alternatives as to why Ms. Goff shot her husband.
Counsel, this is a little context because it wasn't clear from the briefs. The defendant's expert testified as to what the battered wife syndrome is, or that she acted in accordance with it, or both?
Both, Your Honor.
All right. There was some indication that there was an objection to the state's witness because an expert is only to testify to help the jury understand what the syndrome is, not whether the person acted in accordance with that. Could you help clarify that for me? I was a little uncertain about that.
I think that is a confusing issue, but... I would refer the court to 2901.06, where we state that the person, being the person who is battered, is the person who is allowed to bring in an expert. And they are allowed to bring in the expert, introduce expert testimony of the battered woman syndrome, and expert testimony that the person suffered from that syndrome as evidence to establish the requisite belief of imminent danger of death or great bodily harm.
Okay.
Ms. Brown, are you saying that it's only the defendant that may offer this type of testimony and the state has no recourse? I mean, when I look at 2945-371F, and I believe that you're reading it rather narrowly to say that it only applies when there's a defense of insanity or mental problem. But it seems to me that if you're raising the issue of battered women's syndrome, that's not something in the ordinary expertise of either the judge on the bench in a bench trial here or the jury in a jury trial. And isn't the intent of F and the way that it's written to suggest that if this issue is raised, the state may then ask for an examination of the defendant?
They may, if it's battered woman syndrome and it's insanity.
But you're saying that just raising the issue doesn't bring it within the purview of F. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that when, correct, when, Your Honor, when a woman raises the issue that self-defense and she's a battered woman, suffering from battered woman syndrome, that there is no statute that permits the state to have a compelled examination. And 2901.06, dealing with battered woman, states that the person may bring in this testimony. I mean, this statute's been there for 20 years, and the legislature hasn't moved to change that.
And yet the defendant is raising the issue. It isn't the state that raises the issue. So the defendant has the choice to bring this into the trial. Doesn't the judge or the jury have the right or the need to have the whole syndrome explained in light of the particular individual who's on trial?
Number one, we don't believe that the trial court has that inherent authority, and we believe that to give the trial court that unfettered discretion would be a mistake, because we think that you would have the same type of a situation where the state would be, anytime that they thought something was unfair, they would be requesting that the defendant or a witness be evaluated, and of course the defense would be asking for the same thing. So I hope I answered your question there.
Counsel, you're saying that F 2945.371F would become effective if the plea was both insanity and a battered women's syndrome defense, self-defense argument.
Battered woman syndrome insanity, not self-defense, Your Honor. That statute, the
45.371.
Yes, thank you. Is insanity and competency.
Exactly.
Yes.
And then 06, the battered women, 290106,
right,
doesn't talk about battered women in that section is utilized as a self-defense basis, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
I don't see the mix between a battered woman syndrome and it then becoming an element of insanity or incompetence. I mean, one, you have self-defense, and in the other argument, you've got insanity or incompetence to stand trial.
I believe there's another statute as well, Your Honor, that deals with the battered woman insanity. Those are two issues two different statutes, and again, we believe that F just goes to the battered woman syndrome insanity.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I represent the state of Ohio. I'm an assistant prosecutor from Lawrence County, Ohio. I don't want to talk a lot about the facts because I don't think that's what we're supposed to do here, but I think I need to respond somewhat there so you'll know the background of this case. It's undisputed in this case, and it came from the defendant's statements and her testimony at court, that on the night of the killing, she had not resided with the victim for 60 days. There had been three contacts during the 60 days, all on the phone, all initiated by the defendant, not the victim. On that night, she brought two handguns, parked at a house next door in a carport, walked across the lawn, knocked on his door.
Counsel, you went through those facts in some length in your brief, so I'm more interested in the role that Dr. Resnick played. Let's just accept, for sake of argument, and I'm not saying I accept that argument yet, that he was permitted to examine her. It seems that his testimony was like another prosecutor cross-examining her and examining her inconsistencies rather than looking at what her testimony was and if it fit the battered woman syndrome and let the jury make the decision as to believe her or not. So how do you justify another person up there playing your role, basically cross-examining a defendant rather than being a pure medical testimony?
Our position is, I think it's two things. Well, it is constitutionally, and then is the court authorized to allow the state to have such an examination? And then she raises the appellant in her second assignment, or her proposition is whether the psychiatrist went too far and on the inconsistencies. It was only in rebuttal that we called this the psychiatrist. We would agree that the state would never be allowed, if that wasn't introduced, their psychiatrist by the defendant, that the state would never be allowed in rebuttal.
Yeah, but it's one thing to call a medical expert in rebuttal. It's another thing to have that expert go over all the consistencies and inconsistencies, because some of the facts you were going into, you have a different shade on what you believe with those facts versus what the defendant believes those facts represent. You say, oh, well, she must not have been afraid of him because she didn't see him in those few months or whatever, and they say she was in constant fear of him and he was stalking her and he was hovering around. So they've got very different facts. Mm-hmm. And then you've got a doctor that gets up there and says, well, you have to believe this to get to that statement, rather than saying this is what the syndrome is, and then the jury decides whether to believe her or not.
As the Court of Appeals pointed out, in Dr. Miller's testimony on direct, the defense lawyer questioned him extensively about Resnick's, a lot of these details in Resnick's report. They did already have it in discovery. And so on rebuttal, that's why all that was brought up. When you read the record and read Miller's testimony, it was just they were attacking some of these things and raised it and opened the door. And that's why this Court of Appeals said it was permissible for him to testify about all those things. But when he did it also, and Rule 705 allows an expert to testify to the underlying facts and data that he relied on, and when he testified to these things, he was just explaining why he really couldn't render an opinion one way or the other. Now, you say, why would you need the person to come up and say that? Well, because this man was a nationally renowned Resnick psychiatrist, and the fact that after he did a 40-page report, and you'll see that it's extensive, and all the things he looked into and had an 8-hour meeting with her, after he did all that, he couldn't conclude one way or the other whether she was a battered woman.
Simply because he didn't know whether he believed her or not. That was the crux of his analysis, is I don't think I believe her, so I can't give you a definition.
Well, he didn't say he couldn't believe her. He said
that's
he couldn't.
That's the essence of the way he phrased everything,
well,
but
I'm not sure I believe her. With all due respect, he said that he couldn't determine her credibility. That was for the court to
determine. What's the difference? I can't believe her?
I can't determine
her credibility? What's the difference? It's semantics.
I think saying to someone that I don't believe you is different than saying I don't know whether to believe you or not. I believe there's a difference. Respectfully, I would agree or disagree on that.
In Dr. Resnick's testimony, in pointing out the inconsistencies, did he indicate in any way which one of those he believed, or that there was that the person could not be she could not be believed because there were inconsistencies?
He was giving his bases for why he couldn't render an opinion. And he gave different possible explanations, but because of all the facts and information he had from her, from the police reports, from her confession. So he was explaining why I can't render an opinion because, no, I can't pick one of those over the other. In fact, she may be a battered woman if you believe that account of it, Judge, and that's up to you.
Is your contention then that Dr. Resnick was impeaching the credibility of the defendant's expert, who apparently did not have any problem rendering an opinion?
The Attorney General, in their amicus brief, that's what we were doing. I can honestly tell you that was not why I was offering the psychiatrist. But the effect of it, the court may conclude that's what the effect of it was, but that was not the purpose of calling.
Mr. Anderson, in the absence of Dr. Resnick having an opinion on battered women syndrome for this defendant, why did you offer the expert? What was the legitimate basis for offering Dr. Resnick's testimony in the absence of his ability to offer an opinion?
We had a psychiatrist on the defense side that had concluded that she was a battered woman.
Sure. And even if I understand that, in whether the statute requires it or not, mm-hmm. that in fairness, perhaps the state should be able to rebut in some fashion the opinion testimony of the defense expert. But Dr. Resnick couldn't provide that. He didn't have an opinion. So what's the legitimate reason for offering his testimony?
In the court below, we had an assignment of error about whether an expert can offer an opinion of I don't have an opinion. And the Court of Appeals cited a case in that decision and cited comments to the evidence 702 that says that that's not improper necessarily to allow that into evidence. And why I did it strategically was that they – what we had out there was their psychiatrist, their expert, opining that it was a battered woman syndrome situation.
And you could have attacked all the facts on which he relied in all sorts of cross-examination and other witnesses and other testimony. You could have attacked all of the facts and said to the jury, you can't believe those facts, so therefore the expert witness's testimony is not reliable.
Well, I could have and I did. But when you're in a trial in an adversarial situation, you can't, after the trial, you say, well, I didn't need to really do that. That's easy to say, boy, but when you're in a trial and you're participating, it's adversarial, and you're not sure what the judge or the jury's up there thinking. And I know a lot of times we go into things for judges and juries that they don't even want to hear about, but we think we need to go ahead.
In other words, you wanted to bolster the attacks on the defendant's credibility through Dr. Resnick.
That wasn't my intent. And I'm just being totally honest with the court. I was offering that because our opinion on the state side was that an expert with the credentials of Dr. Resnick, after doing the analysis that he did and came to a conclusion that he couldn't say one way or the other, that is now what you know what we'd rather had on our expert, and of course it's argued that he's such an agent for the state, and we put him up to all this. Well, if he was such an agent for the state, we would have really rather had an opinion that said, well, she's not a battered woman.
All right.
But he
counsel, was the question asked of your witness, Dr. Resnick, you know, if all of this, the premise on which the defense experts based his conclusion, if all of those assume that that is correct and that is the situation, what's your opinion? Would he would have then rendered, well, assuming all of that, yes, she is a battered woman, correct?
I think he said that.
Okay.
He said if the court believes that.
All right. That's my point here. He's saying, yes, I would agree with the defense counsel's expert assuming A, B, and C, and D were true. And he couched that in terms, though, I don't know whether those are true. Now, why is that his purview, privilege to say that? I don't know whether I believe her or whether that is the basis on which the court should rely. That's what I see as being problematic here. Not, you know, here's what the defense premise is, and if you agree with the defense premise, yes, she is a battered woman. However, you as the prosecutor would said, well, doctor, say we don't say fact A is not true. What would your opinion be in that case as to whether or not she's a battered woman? And he could then opine, well, if we don't have that foundation, that's not true. I can say that I would not say that she's a battered woman. Instead of the route that was taken, which to me is problematic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't say for certain that that exact question was asked. What if by either counsel? Well, it wouldn't be by the defense, but by on our side. My recollection was that wasn't answered. It will be in the record. But I don't think it was if all those are true, would you agree with that? What Resnick...
Isn't that part of... I mean, wouldn't that be an appropriate question to ask an expert that you're bringing in for the determination of an explanation, helping the fact finder with regards to this battered women's syndrome?
In hindsight, I was the trial lawyer here, and I am a trial attorney, not normally as much an appellant attorney, but I can say from my experience that I can always look back at every trial, and I wake up in the middle of the night and say, boy, I wish I'd asked that question, but I don't think it's dispositive here. And I'm not so sure that I did or didn't ask the question. This is a 3,300-page transcript. It lasted 12 days. So I don't want to misrepresent it to you. What I would say is our position is, and the Court of Appeals agreed with us, that he was allowed to testify about the possible other explanations for the killing to give his reasons why he couldn't say one way or the other. He wasn't saying she wasn't battered, but he wasn't saying she was. And that's different than saying, well, she's not. But it's still an opinion, and it still had probative value to the trier fact. Now, we would have rather had an answer from our expert the other way. You know, no, it isn't. But their complaint is, well, no, opinion's, you know, not an opinion. But, you know, I'm sure the other side of it would be, well, if he gave an opinion like that, well, he was just an agent for the state. You fed him the questions. That's, you know, it goes both ways.
Mr. Anderson, what we're trying to do is look at this for the sake of other cases that will come down, and based on the rules of law that we articulate here. And the first question relates to whether the exam could have been compelled. Your opponent is saying just by raising the self-defense does not allow the 29-45-31-F 371F to kick in. In other words, you can't require a person to submit to an exam just because they raise the self-defense issue. You have to first have the argument that this was a mental insanity defense. Would you agree with that?
I think this is the two parts of it. One part is constitutional.
Right.
And the second part is if we would pass that test, pass that muster, so to speak, then does the statute or some other authority allow a court to even do it in Ohio? I think those are the two bifurcated items here.
And does it make any difference? I know we're talking about a bench trial rather than a jury trial. Does that make any difference to your analysis?
I don't think that would make any difference here. They're each of them's the trier of fact. But on the first issue, the constitutional issue, on the Fifth Amendment, they cited the Estelle and Smith case, the United States Supreme Court, 1980, in which the prosecutor in its case in chief on a sentencing hearing on death penalty case, the second segment, offered psychiatric testimony of its psychiatrist about the future dangerousness of the person, and that the defendant had never raised any psychiatric. And the court said, no, you can't do that. That violates the right against self-incrimination because they used statements out of that against the defendant. But the court, and that's cited as the main basis for why it's unconstitutional by the defense. But the court went on to say that when it's different than when it's an insanity defense, where the defendant puts that in issue and is going to offer their own expert, then they said if you ruled it's unconstitutional for the state to be able to do it, you would be depriving the state of its only effective means of controverting that. So really, our position is in our brief that Estelle supports our decision. It doesn't, or supports our position, not the appellant's position.
Counsel, you said early in the argument, I've been searching for exactly where in this lengthy Court of Appeals opinion, that the Court of Appeals noted that Dr. Miller opened the door for Dr. Resnick's testimony by criticizing in what the state presented. At this point, Resnick hasn't been called.
Right.
Miller's on the stand in the defense part of the case. And he's asked questions by the defendant's counsel about the flaws in Resnick's report. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And so it's your argument that does that trump everything?
I agree.
Is that just the Court of Appeals view that trumps these other arguments, that once they went into that, then Resnick's report became, and Resnick himself became free game on these questions beyond the question of his psychological or psychiatric evaluation of this woman?
Once we pass the constitutional hurdle, which what we're asking you to do today, two courts of appeal, 19 years apart, in the Manning case, the Nice District, in the Fourth District now in this case, has ruled that when the defendant raises her mental state, in this case battered woman syndrome, and is going to call their expert, it's only fair to have her be examined by the state's expert and allow that person to testify. That's consistent with Estelle and Smith. It's just extending basically this infant doctrine, 20 years old, it's extending that same logic of a mental state, and they have an expert. That's an effective waiver of their constitutional right. Now, once you're past that and you talk about is there any authority to call the person, first of all, the Court of Appeals talks about, and we do in our brief, the inherent authority of a court. In fact, even in the Davis case, which is a Sixth Circuit case that was interpreting Rule 12.2 and said you can't do it under that, a federal rule, but they also said, but a court has inherent authority in the interest of fairness. The defendant's entitled to a fair trial, the Sixth Amendment, but not a more than fair trial. Fair means both ways. If someone gets more than a fair trial, the other person gets less than a fair trial. That's why, for how many years, I don't know, in insanity and incompetency, once that person comes out from behind the Fifth Amendment and says, I'm raising this, I'm going to have an expert, then the state is to sit there and say, well, we can cross-examine you, and maybe that'll help, but we can't have you you evaluate. And the court said, and the Supreme Court even, U.S. Supreme Court, has said, no, that wouldn't be fair. And we're just asking you to extend this
and it
to a battered woman.
It doesn't matter that your expert that you call can't form an opinion. You're still entitled to call them. And this last part that they opened the door with respect to his observations that go beyond a psychiatric evaluation.
And that was the other part of your question, and I'm sorry, but I wanted to get to right. Where we get. We have to get past constitutional before right. We get to that. So I think we are past that based on the Estelle, Buchanan, and Powell cases by the U.S. Supreme Court, and then that there's no difference between battered woman and insanity for these purposes of this analysis. Once it's raised, state of mind, expert, we get to do it. Now, how do we get to do it? Well, we believe we could call the person that analyzed her for us, and that was probative to say, I did all this analysis, and I can't conclude that she was a battered woman. Now, I can't conclude she wasn't, but I can't conclude she was. That's a different opinion than the opinion that she was. Now, what about the questions we asked, though? And that's, I think, the crux of your question, Justice Pfeiffer, and that is, on direct examination, we present our case. We don't mention a thing about a psychiatrist or anything else. They come back. They choose to call Dr. Miller. Their counsel ask him, preemptively, knowing that we're probably going to call Resnick in rebuttal, they ask a lot of questions about why did you say that in there? Why did you say this and why did you say that? We know a basic premise of our law, and I hear it every day in trial courts, counsel, you opened the door. You opened the door. And then we've got to respond. I think Resnick's testimony would have been more limited by me had that, but in the heat of the battle, and that's just happened, then in a trial, I'm responding. It's adversarial. We know it is. I mean, that's the way it is in the pits of a trial. And when you're in there, you can always look back and say,
counsel,
boy, I wish
counsel,
I would.
Counsel, just a minute. When the defense put their expert on and it was asked, why did you say this? On what did you base your expert opinion? And the doctor would say, I based it on A, B, and C. And was the question then asked of the expert, do you believe A, B, and C happened?
No.
Okay, so that wasn't asked on direct of
no.
Dr. Miller.
No.
And so then you put on Dr. Resnick for rebuttal.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. I thought you were talking about if I asked that to Resnick, so I misunderstood.
No, I'm talking about Dr. Miller,
okay.
Who was the expert for the defendant.
I do not know if he was asked if he believed.
Because it's irrelevant what he believed. Am I correct?
Well.
Assume A, B, and C are true. Doctor, is this indicia of battered women defense or syndrome?
When Miller was being questioned?
Yes.
Well, it's always couched in if this happened.
Exactly.
I mean, he wasn't
there.
He can't say I was there and I saw it, obviously.
I understand that.
Yeah,
but
sure.
Nobody asked Dr. Miller, do you believe this happened?
Mm-hmm.
Did they? I mean, that's not what you ask an expert witness. Do you believe what the defendant is saying
is the scenario? Neither psychiatrist was asked, do you believe it?
So then you get Dr. Resnick on, and is he the one that brought up the issue of credibility of the defendant here? In other words, I would like to render an opinion, but I don't know if I believe her, so I'm not going to, find it. I can't find it one way or the other.
But her credibility was always at issue. The fact that the first expert, let's say for argument, and I can't remember exactly, but I think that was an ask, wasn't opining about whether to believe her or not.
Wait a minute. You can't ask an expert. Is she telling the truth? Do you believe this? Is this a fact that happened? None of that is within the scope of the testimony of an expert witness.
Resnick was doing two things in his testimony. He was rebutting attacks on things that they raised about these different findings that he made. If you look in his testimony, that was all out there. And so, when you're rebutting and you're in there in a trial, you're going to think, well, we need to respond to that. So they did open the door, and we rebutted it. Whether it would have been as appropriate if it hadn't even been raised at all, that would be another issue.
But counsel, the question is whether he was asked, did he believe such and such testimony or not? Was he ever asked that question?
Are you talking about Miller or Resnick?
I'm sorry, I'm talking about Resnick.
Resnick, no. What he said was he gave a conclusion at the end. And he said, I can't say that she was or was not a battered woman. Her credibility it's right out of the transcript. Her credibility is up to the court. I can't. And he was confirming that it's not about believing her or not. But because there were different accounts of it from all the information he had, he said, I can't pick one of them. But if the one that she's talking about, that she testified to, and if the court believes that's credible, then that would be a battered woman. But I'm just explaining to you, court, which he's allowed to do under 702, why I can't say more than I can tell you. I'm explaining this to you, why I can't do it. Coupled with the fact that on the Miller testimony, it was raised repeatedly, and so we went into the details of it because it hadn't been raised. But we believe respectfully that this does not violate the Constitution. It's the same thing as insanity or
thank competency. You, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you.
Ms. Brown, 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. With a wink and a nod, Dr. Resnick told the trial court that credibility was up to him. I think it's important for this court to know that Dr. Resnick...
Who's the him when you...
To the trial judge.
All right.
Sorry, Your Honor. I think it's important for this court to know that prior to Dr. Resnick's evaluation of Megan Goff, that he was given over 40-some pieces of evidence from the state. A lot of those included police investigative reports and witness statements. They were witnesses the state was going to use that the defense never did get.
Are you saying that your expert's testimony might have been different had they gotten those 40 pieces of evidence?
No, what I am saying, Your Honor, is that what Dr. Resnick did, rather than do an examination he didn't do any psychological testing, and rather than do an evaluation of Megan Goff, he confronted her with these witness statements to see to hear what her response would be. Then when he testified on rebuttal, he said, here are the inconsistencies that I found between what the evidence I had gotten from the state and what she told me.
So you're saying that Dr. Miller did do a psychological evaluations of your client and Dr. Resnick did not?
Correct, Your Honor. And if you look at the reports, there were several tests that Dr. Miller did.
And are those standard tests for this? I mean, how did he couch those tests as to their relevance to his diagnosis?
He couched them as, my opinion was that he was couching them as, I'm trying to determine if she indeed is a battered woman.
And these are standard tests that are accepted in the psychiatric profession for this type of a determination?
I would imagine that they would be. We all know when things are... Oh, I think I have a red light.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank
Brown.
Thank you.